Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you'll need to join the millions of others who have switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday. Odoo, modern management made simple. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, late March 2009, H1N1 is spreading throughout the United States, particularly in California and Texas at first. It was more commonly known as the swine flu and had come to U.S. shores most likely through Mexico. But over the course of March and April, it would spread and spread, initially caught an outbreak, then being designated a public health emergency by the WHO and CDC, and then by the summer, a pandemic. I think we are all way too familiar with that course of designations by this point. The pandemic would rage throughout the summer and then begin to taper off in the fall, just about a year after the initial designation it was declared over. How many people died? It's a little hard to figure out, but there's an official number of about 20,000. There are estimates that maybe it's closer to 250,000. Not to make this about COVID, but of course, we are a few years into COVID. There are several million people dead. So there are lots of parallels and lots of things to think about with the H1N1 story and a conversation about the lessons that we learned and especially the ones that we seem to have not learned from 2009. So here to discuss, as always, are Nicole Hemmer of Vanderbilt and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
And our special guest for this episode back on the show is Dr. James Hamblin, lecturer at the Yale School of Public Health, longtime health writer. His books are Clean and If Our Bodies Could Talk. Jim, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me back to discuss swine flu once again.
Yes, once again. And look, I should say, Jim and I are really good friends. The last time I think you were on the show, we got an email from someone being like, you should disclose that the two of you are friends. And it's like, I'm like, all right, we're friends, folks. It was a very strange pushback. But I also am like, what's the point of having a podcast if you're not going to talk to your friends? That's like literally
really?
What we're here to do. So, but Jim, nice to see you.
It's good to see you, Jody.
People can tell our deep rapport and friendship.
We did talk about the 1976 swine flu.
That's true. Okay, so perfect.
I wasn't.
We did talk about that.
Yeah.
No, I know. Right. So actually, that was my first question: is to give us a sketch of what is this particular disease, how new was it, and what are its symptoms and so forth, and just sort of place us in that context.
Right. Okay. Well, the flu is a virus that most of us, probably all of us, have had. And it's constantly evolving and changing, and it goes through animals and mutates in ways that surprise us every year, and we can never perfectly predict. It goes through birds, through swine, and the naming tends to be something that's rather arbitrary, but it's a version of the flu. The 2009 outbreak, pandemic, was similar, at least in initial stages, to the flu that most of us have had. But there was a higher than usual rate of people kind of dropping off a cliff, like really declining around days 3 to 5, not unlike you saw and still see with COVID, and needing to go to the hospital, needing ventilation. So that was what I think really shocked a lot of the world, is this is not the flu we're familiar with. This strikes us as something else. And it also was affecting people who were, otherwise pretty healthy and young, which also raised a lot of alarms.
And it comes just like maybe 6 years after an avian flu outbreak, H5N1, that had emerged in Asia. And that had such a high mortality rate of something like 60% of people who contracted it, even though it had a lower sort of contagion rate, that there had been a process put in place over those 6 years to try to respond well in the event that another sort of virulent form of the flu started to circulate. So when H1N1 finally shows up in 2009, there was kind of a flu plan that was in place that is going to kick into gear once this is identified.
Yeah, and I think it's correct me if I'm wrong, but it also originated, they suspect, from small pigs in Central America. And then a little boy, a five-year-old boy, gets the virus. And from there, it really takes off and starts to spread. And it's only a matter of time before it makes its way to the United States. But, you know, in those first few weeks, pretty scary not knowing necessarily how to combat something like this.
Jim, what is your sense of how much of a plan was in place and how much, you know, the U.S. infrastructure had learned lessons? We'll get to the lessons we may have learned from this, but how much was the response at that time a product of lessons that had been learned in previous outbreaks?
We tend to fluctuate in our responses to outbreaks in that we are overcautious after something where we were previously undercautious and then we're undercautious. And in this instance, we may have erred on the side of being a little more prepared than we would have been before. But it's also hard to say because, you know, there were still a lot of people who were affected by this and a lot more that could have been done.
I mean, I remember, you know, early in COVID days, people like you were saying kind of the sign that we treated this well is we'll think we overreacted. It's
right.
Sort of a catch-22.
Yeah, there were some school closures in 2009, measures that might that seemed dramatic when you look back at the actual numbers, but that is always the challenge that public health faces. Is if you proposed and implemented an effective preventive measure, then it looks like it was unnecessary.
And those are the kinds of conversations that were happening inside the Obama administration. Like, if we respond to this effectively, it won't spread as much and it will look like we over-responded to it, but that's what we have to do in order to prevent this from becoming a bigger crisis. Because, by the way, we have like five other crises that are going on right now, and we don't need a devastating pandemic on top of it. And so you have, it's actually kind of interesting, you have within the federal government, the pandemic response is in the Department of Homeland Security, which also has its hands full in 2009 with a number of different issues. And so you have kind of a split response happening within the government. Part of it is in DHS, part of it is in Health and Human Services. And yet they coordinate around the pandemic pretty well because they have interagency people who are talking to one another. And then you get kind of this robust response, not robust enough to stop, again, like 20,000 to 250,000 people from dying, but a pretty robust response to the pandemic as it emerges.
Yeah, I got to say, I'll take an overreaction any day over something that, you know, is much less prepared for. I mean, I don't know. I think this could have been a lot worse than it was. And it's always better to say things could have been worse and weren't.
Jim, do you have a sense of how the vaccine for this came together? I mean, it doesn't seem like there was a huge push to come up with a completely new vaccine. Did they sort of were they able to largely use existing vaccines? And then just in a general sense, like, how does that come together? Is it usually the case that a vaccine approach for a previous flu will largely help with the current one?
Well, what we do is try to look for ways that we can implant tracking devices into the skin of children. And any way we can do that.
5G has helped so much with that.
It's fine. We just do it as quickly as possible. What happens every year with the flu is it's mutating so much, and the way those mutations manifest is by through these proteins, hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, which are on the surface of the virus, HN. They have different numbers, different combinations that we know of become notorious. And we try to guess, like, very early on, because we need to stay ahead of this, what are three of the strains that are looking most likely to become the dominant one this year. And we'll put a few of those into a vaccine. I say we. I don't personally make vaccine. the medical community will agree on three of them, get them into a vaccine, and usually one of those ends up becoming the dominant strain and people get partial protection and the vaccine helps out. In this one, it was more of a retroactive process. So you had this known virus going around and you then later had to create a vaccine targeted at it after it was already spreading, which is not unprecedented. It's certainly more similar to what we did with COVID than what happens in the typical flu season.
Although it does seem like one of the differences is that, correct me if I'm wrong, that it was modeled after a flu vaccine. So it was considered safe and potentially effective, as opposed to being like a new technology or newer technology like mRNA vaccination.
Yeah, yeah. That's a kind of double-edged sword, I think. Partly, people tend to not worry too much about the flu and not take preventive measures because it's a familiar disease or a familiar virus that people have had and lived through and know people who've lived through it. And so that's bad. But on the other hand, people have also gotten flu shots and know they're not that bad. So that was a plus that you had more buy-in and certainly a lot fewer people trying to profit from stoking fears about this vaccine.
Well, so I think that's where we should go now and talk about all the very tricky things around fear and propaganda and the sort of discourse and politicization around these things. There's a bunch of places we could start. I guess, Nikki, I mean, you've talked with the Obama folks as part of your Obama Oral History Project about this specific incident. Did they have to contend with politicization in any way? I mean, Obama wasn't immune to conspiracy theories, but what was going on in the sort of spring of 2009 when this broke out?
Nor was he immune to the swine flu. And in fact, one of the things that they do in order to build public trust is they have Obama and other administration officials take the vaccine on camera and sort of show, oh, go get your flu vaccine in order to protect yourself. There absolutely were conspiracy theories that were circulating at the time. Alex Jones was always on the pandemic beat whenever something sprung up in the news, even if something didn't spring up in the news. And you had anti-vaccination people and a movement even in 2009. But it didn't have the same level of politicization, in part because there was just a lot going on in 2009. People were focusing on the potentially passing of the ACA. You had the Tea Party movement emerging at the time. You had the global financial meltdown.
Housing crisis.
There was plenty for people to worry about and to spin up conspiracy theories about. And it also was a disease that, in retrospect, looking backwards from COVID, like didn't disrupt people's lives in the same way. And so it had much less of kind of that central focus that allows for these conspiracy theories to build and merge and evolve, much the way a virus does.
I would agree with that. There was also a more limited time window. So if you recall, during the earliest days of the COVID pandemic, everyone was pretty much on the same page, like, this is serious, we need to do something about it. And it takes time before people develop into these camps, reactionary camps. And when you have something like a flu outbreak, you only have a few months before it's on the wane, and you can start to see improvement and move on. And there's more polarization that develops as an issue becomes chronic.
Yeah. So it happened pretty freaking quick with COVID, if we recall.
Each day of the early pandemic was a month for me.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
But you also had an administration that was sending mixed messages about the pandemic, which I think was part of the challenge as well.
To say the least.
Yeah.
Hey there, Jody here, and I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a brand new season. This is their 13th season, and the show just keeps getting better. Now, I don't know if you know, but Ear Hustle is the show about life inside prison, but it is not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons, and now they have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships inside prison, and stories of incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. These are stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. I'll be listening, and I hope you will too. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts. On the media front, you know, how do you feel, Jim, about the fact that this got the name swine flu? The previous one had gotten bird flu. Does that help it pop through the public consciousness? No.
Well, I'd say it's better than naming these strains after the places of origin, which is also sometimes done. And it's maybe better for public awareness than calling it, anything too technical. But I don't have a perfect solution for how these things could be named, because you do want to emphasize this is something new and novel and not necessarily something your previous cases of infection or previous vaccines will protect you from without... making it sound like a totally new disease. I don't have a good solution to the nomenclature problem, but plus I really like pigs and they didn't mean to do harm.
They did nothing wrong.
Yeah.
There is some murkiness about whether this actually did come through swine in Mexico or whether it came from other parts of the world. And, you know, I guess it leads to that basic question, like, does it really matter if we know where exactly it came from? And we're certainly having a big debate about that now with COVID.
It really matters if we were going to take action to prevent that from happening again. But it doesn't sound like
concept.
We are. So it's kind of academic. I mean, it's always a nice curiosity, but it's not really in the public interest if there's nothing you can do about it. And we're not going to pass any policies or change anything that would prevent this from happening again.
And on that policy front, I mean, this, we talk about the politicization of pandemics as something of the COVID era, but the politicization around the sort of long-term response to H1N1 started pretty quickly, because the Obama administration does an overview of what they did right and what they did wrong in response to the pandemic. They create a preparedness plan so that they're ready for the next one, and they get it into bills before Congress, and Congress is taken over by Republican lawmakers, and instead of getting more money into preparedness, you get less and less and less over the course of the Obama presidency, because all of those preparedness plans and funding pushes get knocked down by Republican opponents of the administration in the House and the Senate.
Do we know what the response to swine flu was outside of the United States? I mean, was Mexico or Europe or any other country sort of providing like a roadmap or guidance or about how to address the disease, both from a public health standpoint, but also from like a PR standpoint?
Believe it or not, there was a time when the U.S. was looked at as the leader of the world in public health. And I think we are no more, but I think that was a mantle that we were to be the people who were looked toward at the time, and we are no longer. When the WHO declares a pandemic, though, of course, it means that you have widespread cases, and you have experts from all over the world agreeing that this is something serious to be taken seriously, and you have measures that will go into place in certain countries, just because, you know, that designation is powerful. So I don't know about the specifics, but we certainly were not alone in this.
Yeah. And there were multilateral meetings between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, kind of where certainly the swine flu was, the H1N1 was centered for much of the pandemic. And the idea was, look, pandemics don't respect borders. So we need to be having these conversations with our neighbors to make sure that this pandemic response is coordinated, to make sure everybody has the sources and the resources that they need in order to deal with this. There were studies being done about how to more efficiently and effectively make sure the vaccines get to other parts of the world that don't necessarily have easy access to them. So there was a global eye on this, or a global, or at least an international response.
But there were in here a lot of the kind of seeds, it seems, of all the things that went really wrong with COVID in terms of, you know, Kelly, to your point about, you know, trust and public framing and so forth. So, you know, you see some of the reports that were written in the wake of the 2009 pandemic, and they say stuff like, well, you know, there's a lot of confusion about what exactly it means for the WHO to declare a pandemic. And some agencies are more interested in prescribing specific tactics, while other agencies are more interested in talking about uncertainty and so forth. And so, like, all that stuff that, you know, we clearly botched and were unable to navigate seem to have been there. And so, Jim, I'm curious, like, when we start to think about lessons learned or not learned, how much, in terms of public messaging, was there a lesson here that seemed to have not been learned going into the next pandemic?
I'm sure there are many. The lesson that I take away from the 2009 pandemic is the power of what happens when people are dying who are or who are hospitalized, having severe illness, who are not expected to. Mm-hmm. The thing that I think made this so vivid in the public eye were even just a few stories of younger people, like healthy young athletes who are in the intensive care unit. And that seems to trip a wire way more than any large number of cases. When you start to think about people who weren't, you know, scare quotes, supposed to die. And the challenge is always to reframe ourselves to say just because you were old, just because you have a chronic disease, doesn't mean that you were supposed to die of this preventable illness. But that does seem to be what animates a lot of the public.
Yeah, the difference between a kind of deserving and undeserving illness, I think, shapes so much of what the way we talk about a lot of different medical and health issues and public health issues to our detriment.
Or maybe not deserving and undeserving, but like, oh, that sort of checks, or that figures,
right.
You know, like, of course you're sick because you're old, or, well, you don't take care of yourself. So that makes sense. But for people that we think eat well, or runners or athletes or whatever, there's a sort of like exceptionality around their identity that we don't think they are susceptible to getting diseases,
right,
and
right,
getting sick.
All right. Well, as we wrap up, I mean, I'm not going to bend and twist myself to try and find a hopeful takeaway here, but I will let you, Jim, sort of, if you want, you know, sketch kind of where we are now. If we're talking about 2009 lessons learned, do you see any concerted effort to learn some lessons from the COVID era?
I think it is commendable that there was any sort of earnest attempt at accountability, at taking stock of what was done well and what was not. I think that's so important. You know, what's happening right now is just kind of people playing politics when we really do need a recap of what went wrong here, what could we do better, how are we better prepared next time? And that's not, to my knowledge, happening earnestly. And then, you know, the lesson about assigning blame to a point of origin is even more problematic now than it was then, because we need a global alliance of people who can communicate openly when they think something is, you know, spreading, when they think there is a way to reduce the potential sources of this sort of outbreak. And we don't have that at all with China right now. And so somehow, you know, depoliticizing this is absolutely necessary and really the only way forward. And I see right now engaging with it as a partisan political issue is the fundamental problem.
Mm-hmm. I will say one hopeful note that I hear there is that, you know, I think there was a reaction in many places to this idea that free and open societies are actually a danger because, you know, people can move across borders freely. And what we need to do is we need to look inward. And it fed a kind of nationalist politics in a lot of places. But having free and open information and having people being able to communicate clearly and have accountability and clear reporting and all of these different things that are part of having a free and open society seems like something that would help to prevent or to help deal more effectively with future pandemics. And that seems like a good lesson to take from it.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will leave it there then. Jim Hamblin of Yale School of Public Health, and his books are Clean and If Our Bodies Could Talk. Thank you, as always, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thanks, Jody.
And Kelly Carter-Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
We are continuing to closely monitor the emergency cases of the H1N1 flu virus throughout the United States. I've asked every American to take the same steps you would take to prevent any other flu. Keep your hands washed. Cover your mouth when you cough. Stay home from work if you're sick, and keep your children home from school if they're sick. We'll continue to provide regular updates to the American people as we receive more information, and everyone should rest assured that this government is prepared to do whatever it takes to control the impact of this virus.
Radiotopia.